I am Marilyn Slater, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Marilyn.
And most grateful to be here, and for the privilege of being here, I'm grateful to Carol for inviting me, and to Steve and Peter and other members of the committee for making me feel so very welcome at this amazing and powerful weekend. You probably didn't guess, but Barney, Beverly, and I are members of the class of 72 together. And we received the gift of sobriety in the same home group. And early on, Barney distinguished himself as the quintessential reader of Chapter 5. And I'm most grateful for that, because that's a large part of what's kept me sober. And we grew up together. And as in Alcoholics Anonymous all over the place, we don't prepare talks. I don't have a slideshow. I don't have a script. Never know what I'm going to say. So that always makes me nervous about an hour before a talk. And Beverly always reminds me that I am a message. And I said it. I am Marilyn Slater, and I'm an alcoholic, and this amazing fellowship has kept me sober for over 22 years now. So I can suffer cardiac arrest and be carried out, and the message has already been given. And everything else is just an elaboration of that basic message. And it's really true. By saying that I'm an alcoholic, of course, that means I'm going to die drunk and cause a lot of harm in my wake. The convention, this roundup, has been a great testimony to that fact. The damage that we can cause is pretty amazing. And yet there is something so powerful in this fellowship that I haven't had to practice my disease for, lo, these 22 years. Truly amazing. When I first came into the fellowship, I was pretty confused. And there was one of those kind of AA cliches about coming. And long after that, coming to. And then a long time after that, coming to believe. So I had come in February 8, 1972. And I seemed to be coming to around Christmas time. So my journey has been a slow one. And those were early memories. There was a Christmas tree and my three little children. And there were presents under the tree because my mother had come to visit and a grandma was there. And I can remember my little son David opening 26 Christmas presents. And then he burst into tears. And my mother said, "David, why are you so sad? What's wrong?" And he said, "Because I didn't get just what I always wanted." And she said, "Well, what is that, David?" And he said, "I don't know. I just know I didn't get it." That was one of the first things I heard as I came to, and I thought, yes, it's the story of my life. That's how it always felt. And I blamed Ohio for a long time. Too much corn. I left Ohio seeking, I wasn't even seeking happiness. I just wanted to be rid of the pain and the anxiety that living produced for me. And Ohio was a pretty place with happy people, and that made me even more nervous. Happy people have always made me pretty tense. And and I'd lie out in the fields, and I'd look up at the stars, and there were billions and billions, as Carl Sagan says, and just thought, man, this is a big universe, and this is a small planet, and people are smaller still, and what's it all about? Now, I come from a long line of proud atheists, so we don't ask questions like that around the house. It's considered bad form. And I just think it's interesting that this is called a spiritual meeting, and here I am from a line of proud atheists, and proud to be an atheist for a long time, delivering a spiritual message. Well, I hope to deliver a spiritual message. But any AA meeting, of course, is a spiritual meeting, as we all know. And so I was a budding atheist, lying in the fields, looking up the stars, and just thinking, what are we here for? And the best thing I could come up with is, life is hard, and then you die. So I didn't have a whole lot of hope in Ohio. But I went off to the big city, and by this time I had learned an escape from pain, and that was to disappear into books, and I liked science. Looking back on it from the perspective of several years in Alcoholics Anonymous, I see that that was my higher power for a long time. And it did a lot of the things that we come to expect from our higher powers, and that is it promised to give me answers about life. What is our purpose here? It could give me a sense of purpose, too. If I could learn to be a scientist and do science, it would employ me and take care of those things we expect from God, namely security and a shelter and a paycheck. So it was pretty good there for a while. So I went off to the big university to study. And I went into the University of Chicago, and there were those hallowed halls. And yet I ended up in a room with another person. And she was like somebody from Ohio, happy, waking up in the morning and, oh, it's going to be a good day. How's it going, Marilyn? And I think, what does she expect from me? How is it going? What kind of a question is that? Made me very nervous. And I thought, well, she's a liberal arts major. She's not a scientist. And that's probably it. But I went to get a job at the Fermi Institute, and it was my kind of place because I walked down the hall and there was a picture of a great big particle accelerator and then a picture of the Andromeda Galaxy, and I thought, yes, I'm among friends, things I know and love. And in order to get the job, I had to take a test involving a microscope, and a tall, pale fellow came out. He was so pale that he looked like he had been in a library all of his life. And he just had chalk dust caked all over him. It just puffed out in a wonderful aura. And he gave me the test. And I watched his long, white, slender fingers turning the knobs of a microscope. And I was getting all excited. And I passed the test and went to work there. And my life took a turn for the better. And here was somebody, we sat and we began to talk about Schrödinger's equation. And he went off to Washington and sent me a postcard, and it said, Marilyn, I was thinking about what you were talking about, but all I can come up with is, and then he just wrote out an elegant partial differential equation. And I just thought, no man has ever talked to me like this before. Now, he hadn't met anybody like me either, mind you. And we got married. And I thought, now this should be right. Finally, I'm starting to study science. I've even married a real scientist, and I should be a happy person. But we'd start the day out with Gegenbauer polynomials or something like that, and it was starting to wear a little bit thin. And then one day we started talking about gravitational force after a couple of weeks, I said something, and he said, that's silly. And he whipped out some elegant equations and put me to shame. Now, I'll tell you, life has always been painful, but it's acute pain when I'm publicly humiliated. Don't like that at all, no. I felt deep humiliation there, and I started shrieking and screaming. We just stopped talking to each other for, I think it was about 13 years. And that is another thing. You know, you come, you get some insight in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went through life without people yelling and screaming at me. They generally treat me pretty gently. And it's only in these later years that I've had a clue about that. You can yell and scream at me once, and then I never talked to you again. So my circle of friends got ever smaller as the years went by, because that kind of thing terrifies me. If anybody humiliates me or yells at me or bests me or criticizes me or says an unkind word to me, I would like to just say no more. I will retreat just a little bit farther back into fear. Of course, into fear. And that's what I did with Bill. He was not too disturbed by that because he loves physics, and he went on doing science very well. And we just kind of passed each other in hallways, and we had a cat that saved the day because I could say to Abelard, our cat was Abelard, and Abelard asked Bill to pass the salt, and he could say, Abelard asked Marilyn if she'd like some pepper too, and it worked, and we came to California with the cat between us in the car, and I was getting closer to my goal. By this time, I looked like a scientist. I was working in a lab with a white lab coat, and it even had holes in it from acid burns, and I just felt so. And I thought, I should start feeling good one of these days. But here I was at home with a stranger by this time, and I was in a lab, and they'd do that thing to me. I'd walk in the morning, and they'd look up, and somebody would say, "Hi, how are you?" I think, they're after me again. I kind of pull my lab coat up and hunker down, and my nerves would jangle for a couple of hours, and then I'd get into work, and I was realizing that I look like a scientist, but now there was something else that was causing even more anxiety, and that feeling that I am not a part of things, and that was that I now was feeling like a fraud. As I said, I almost looked the part now. But I thought, it's only a matter of time before they see through me and know that I just can't do any of this stuff. And I was working on a muscle biochemistry project, and I just thought that that's going to do it for me. If I can work so hard and just do super science, then one day I might get the Nobel Prize, and then I'll be a happy person, because finally I will get some respect. I just felt like Rodney Dangerfield all my life. I just don't get no respect. And I just went around feeling that way. And yet I thought that would do it. And in those days you would say, well, what would convince you, Marilyn, that you did fit in, that you had the love and respect of others? And I'll tell you, what I wanted was a room like this. And if I would come in that door, all activity would stop. And there would be a murmur, Marilyn, Marilyn, turning toward the door, reaching out, dropping to knees, creeping forward toward me. That's what I wanted, because you see, if that was happening, I'd know that I was just like everybody else. That's what I thought. And that would get me high for about 5 minutes, and then I'd think, but they don't really mean it. I just felt like there was a big wall between me and them. Them was everybody else in the universe. Felt it at home with my husband, certainly, and I felt it by this time with the cat, and I felt it with the people in the lab, and I'd walk around and I'd see threesomes and foursomes, happy people talking to one another. I was observing it outside this morning, that happy crowds formed threesomes and foursomes, and in those days when I felt so alone, I just wished that I could enter into a threesome, and I every now and then tried, and I'd just step up and I'd think, I've got to ask a question. They seem to ask each other questions, and I'd try to think of a question, and I'd just come in and I'd say, "Hi guys, you like tacos?" And they'd just look at me weird and turn and form other threesomes and be standing there all alone. And I just felt the wall all the time. There were those rare moments, though. Every now and then somebody would say something like, Marilyn, when we were in the lab, they'd say, Marilyn, what do you think is the role of calcium in excitation-contraction coupling? And then I could say, why, I think that calcium is released by the sarcoplasmic reticulum. It binds to the myosin ATPase, causes conformational change in the enzyme, actin and myosin interdigitate, and that's muscle contraction. And I'd think, yes, we're communicating. But you see, it was so rare that they asked the right question. Life was painful, and And as I continued to work, I felt worse than ever. The fraud syndrome was really setting in, the sense of isolation. And I don't know why I didn't just kill myself. I figured out in Ohio a long time ago that life is hard and then you die. So why not put an end to it right away? Well, I really didn't know. I puzzled over that, even into sobriety. And then one day I heard my friend Charlie C., who was our speaker last night, talking. And he said something. He said, not very many alcoholics commit suicide because it involves such a long commitment. But yes, yes. And I wasn't big on commitments, no. And And so I just kept muddling through. But probably I would have gotten so desperate that I would have been willing to gamble on the long commitment. But something happened. It was the first spiritual experience of my life. And it happened in Shakey's Pizza Parlor, actually. We'd gone there after work, and I didn't like to go there after work because that meant social time and that talk between others and me and plexiglass wall between me and everybody else and sitting there trying to think of a question to ask and thinking, now they're looking at me. They see I'm sitting here alone. They don't like me, do they? Now I should ask something. I'd look furtively and say, are you wearing shoes? And wrong question again. And so it was going to be one of those times out with the gang. But instead, they brought around a whole lot of beer, and I just quickly downed about 5 mugs of that stuff. And it was like all the promises in the big book came true for me. 30 seconds. And wonderful. Shakey's became an intense technicolor, truly a glow, yes. And it was meltdown time, plexiglass wall, just melted down. And I was speaking the same language as everybody else there and singing the same songs and dancing the same dances, and nobody else was dancing, but it was just wonderful. And I felt like a real scientist. And so you can see that if something could provide what I was looking for. I mean, it just was getting close to that present number 27. I never did get just what I always wanted, but that was awfully close. It was peace of mind, the good old doubt, and I felt like I had a sense of purpose. I am a scientist. I felt that I had the love and respect of the people around me. We all seemed to be glowing there together. So with such a magic thing as that, you can see that I was not so stupid. I was arrogant and pretty silly, but I knew enough to just bring lots of that stuff into the lab. I lived in the lab, my husband lived at work, and so that was the home that I knew. And there was just something that told me I can't stack that stuff up on my desk. 17 cases of beer. So I had to change my experiment a little bit. You see, I was working on the biochemistry of muscle, so I wrote into my proposal, the biochemistry of muscle at low temperatures. Move all that stuff into the cold room. And I worked in this refrigerated room with lots of shelves, lots of cases of beer. And already I had the respect of my colleagues there. I'd come in the morning and I'd put on a great big parka and pull open that refrigerated door, and already I could just see the admiration in their eyes. That Marilyn, working all day long in the cold. And I'd sigh nobly and go in and slam the door shut and pop open the cans of beer, and I enjoyed my work. The Nobel Prize was that close. And I'm there right now. Had not a revolting development come up in my life. Years went by, 2 or 3, and one day the director said, Marilyn, it's time to write it all up now, just what you've been doing here. And that was about 10 grades worse than how are you. And I was saying to myself, let me just think. I've got to think about this. So I went home and I sat on my couch for about 3 months. I couldn't think of a good explanation for what I'd been doing there. And I had gotten a lot of full cans in, a lot of empties out, but it wasn't going to fly as a biochemistry project. And So I just mailed the keys back after several months went by and took the phone off the hook and sat there. And there was a lot of light in the house, even though I drew the blinds. And so I retreated to my garage. It was darker and cooler there, and I could sit on the floor. And I had thought that it was science that had given me that joy, that sense of purpose, that delight in being alive. It was, of course, alcohol, and in those days, any alcohol would do. There was lab alcohol available in a metal cabinet, and you could mix it with the vending machine 7-Up and have quite a nice evening. And so there was so much joy, so much fulfillment, and it was all over. Science had given it to me, and it had taken it away from me. I knew I could never work again. And so I just retreated to my garage, and I just sat there. And as in the days in Ohio, I became philosophical again. And I just looked at the floor thinking, what is it all about? And in those days, I noticed that there were a lot of ants in our garage. Again, that's something that the clarity of sobriety has allowed me to figure out. You see, by this time my aim was very bad, and I'd open a can, and half the time it would go down my back and fall on the floor and evaporate, leaving behind complex sugars. The ants were coming in for a feast every day. And I just saw them coming in these trails, and I just said to myself, these little fellows, they know how to do it. They've got friends and jobs and a sense of purpose. These simple creatures, and I missed it all. Now, as I said, I just have no memory of communication with my husband at all in these bleak and terrible years. However, our house was filling with little children, and they seemed to be mine. I was very confused by this time, and my husband was working long hours, going out at 7 in the morning, coming back at midnight, and I felt like I've got to get in the house and take care of these little children. And I just, for a long time, I didn't even remember these years, and I realized that it wasn't just the blackout drinking, the gray outs, so much as the pain of remembering, because these were truly terrible times. I came out of a blackout, and Paul Harvey's voice was calling out in the background, "We find that women alcoholics go downhill faster than men. They have about 10 years before the first drink and the time they're institutionalized." And I was counting. And as he was saying that, I was holding my infant daughter and trying to shield her head from the wall as I bounced off of it. I was just trying to get from one room to another. And here was this little one. And there were other little ones. We had 3 of them during these years. And I'd come out of a blackout in a car, driving around, going after something to drink, and little ones would be crying in the back seat. And I'd come to in a car, having thrown up in the car, and little ones crying in the back seat, or sometimes no little ones. And where were the children when I was out in the car throwing up? Not happy years. And by this time, I began to see, as crazy as I was, that this is not good. And there was one time that my son David was out in the yard, and I saw him, and this was one of those days when I said, I'm not going to drink today. I'm going to clear my mind. I'm going to cut back on my drinking, and I'm just not going to drink at all. So I was a little bit cranky that morning. But I looked out the window, and there he was, and he had broken a toy, and he was just a teeny little guy. And I ran out, and I started shaking and screaming, I wish you were dead. And the poor little guy just fell on the ground and cried and cried. And I slunk off to the garage and said to myself, I am a monster. I've got to stop living like this. My husband had surely begun to notice, because half the time I was passed out on the floor in the car when he came home, and often with cuts and bruises all over. And he said a couple of times, you've got to stop doing this. And I didn't seem to hear him. So he's a man of action, and he moved his mother in. And she really noticed. And this is just another one of those patterns that I've observed in Alcoholics Anonymous, that that you see, I didn't like her very much. And I certainly did not have a theological bent, as I told you. But I thought she had a big red tail just coiling out from under her robe. And one day she said to me, "Marilyn, unless you stop drinking and unless you get control of your life, we're going to take the kids away and you'll never see them again." And I thought, she has her nerve talking to me like this right in my own garage. But she meant it. And I began trips into Alcoholics Anonymous. And as I said, I just feared and loathed my mother-in-law. And yet, I have come to see that one of these very scary things has turned out to be one of the greatest blessings in my life. Had it not been for her encouragement, I might not have ever made it here. And to die was not important to me by this time. My life was worthless and terrible, but I could have caused such terrible damage to the kids at home, and I was certainly damaging them minute by minute by that kind of living. It's largely because of her that stopped eventually. But I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and the first time I came in, I was introduced to this big, active Pacific group with happy people and threesomes and foursomes and, "Hi, Marilyn, how are you?" I just thought, this is not for me. I had always been fearful, but a lot of years of garage drinking, darkness added on to that basic fear, and then coming out light and sober was not a happy time for me, I'll tell you, with happy people. And I tried to learn the secret. Don't take that first drink. I wanted to learn the secret and then just go and practice it in the quiet of my garage. I wanted to learn Alcoholics Anonymous as a spectator sport. And of course it didn't work. I watched, though, and I watched a person named... She was a radiant being. She just seemed to glow from the inside out, and I was always too fearful to approach her, but I watched her. And since I was such an ignorant and arrogant and self-will run riot kind of person, it just didn't work for me. And I went home and drank until alcohol beat me down so much that one day I raised the white flag. And I love the theme of this roundup, surrender to win. That felt so terrible to get to that point. You see, I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous while I was out there going to any lengths to practice my disease. And I kept saying to myself, if it ever gets bad enough, I guess I can turn myself into those fanatics. Now, I was doing nothing but garage drinking and upsetting my mother-in-law, who had to live with us to take care of our children. But you see, from that point of view, I felt like a free spirit, just contemplating the ants and thinking, if it ever gets bad, there's always a place to go. I felt like I had a lot of freedom. What I chose to do with my freedom was sit and drink all day long. But it felt like freedom while I was drinking. AA looked like a fanatic organization. One day I came out of a blackout. My mother-in-law was there tending the children, and I was in a 12-step call on me. Now, when you come out of a blackout and somebody's talking to you about Alcoholics Anonymous and implying that you made a call, that's a real surprise. And she stayed with me that day and said she was going to take me to a meeting. And I said, well, okay, but don't take me to the Pacific group. I'm a quiet person. I'm a scientist, and I need quiet AA. She said, that's fine. There are many, many meetings. This is Los Angeles. There are many, many different kinds of AA here. And I said, do you know somebody named Marion? No, she didn't know Marion. But she said, if I come back, I might find her if she's still sober. And so I went off, and my head hurt a lot. And I had encouraged Lorena to go away and let me rest. And she said, no, you can rest. I'll just sit here and watch you. It's awfully hard to get out the beer while a person from the program is sitting there in your living room. So by the time we got to the meeting, my head was pounding and I wanted to sleep. And thank God she took me to a dark, quiet meeting, so I got in some fairly good sleep during the first half. And then at coffee break time, they were shuffling and... Oh, head pounding again, and what am I doing here? This is horrible that it's come to this. Yes, wonder if I could ever meet her. Oh, I wish they'd quiet down. And pretty soon they were settling down again. I thought, good, I can go off to sleep. And then I heard the leader say, and our main speaker tonight is Marion W. And I looked up, and there she was, the radiant Marion. And she told my story, and I heard it. And I heard that she had been like me. And then I knew that she had some kind of joy, kind of contentment, a sense of fulfillment that I couldn't even imagine possible that a human being could have. And I did what I'm sure saved my life. I said, Marion, will you be my sponsor? And she said, I'd be happy to. It's a privilege to do that. Now, of course, you must go to the meetings that I go to. And you probably guessed it. She circled the meetings of the Pacific Group. I said, Marion, that's not for me. I'm a scientist. And I need a quiet kind of AA where they understand people like me. And besides, I can't go back there because once I went there a few years ago and they told me if I kept on doing what I was doing, I'd drink again. And you see, I did drink again, but not just because they were right, but you see, I can't go back there. And she said, I really understand, Marilyn. I understand a lot about pride. And I don't know what gave me the willingness to say, anything is fine, Marion. Anything is okay. I will go along peacefully. And I sort of took the first three steps in a primitive sort of way that night. I certainly, by being there, I was admitting that I can't lick this myself. I am powerless over alcohol. I couldn't control my drinking, and I couldn't even stop drinking because the pain of not drinking overcame me, and I just tried just a little bit to take the edge off. I couldn't stop drinking. I had to give up. And of course I had come to believe because I saw Marion, the creature of light, who told a story like my own, a story that I believed, and she had been there, and it wasn't like that for her anymore. I believed enough to say, in the way that I first took the third step, anything, Marion, because you see, I was turning my will and my life over to something outside of myself, something that I recognized as more powerful than myself. I had no power. I had nothing that was working for me now. And it meant being desperate enough, I guess, being beaten down enough, because that was just the beginning of about 3 years of a lot of pain. Sobriety was not pretty for me. It was not fun. And yet, I was at the end, and I had made the surrender. The surrender made it all possible. And Marion at first began to talk in a way that was frightening me. She said, come a half hour early to one of these big meetings. I can't do that, Marion. People think I'm weird, and they don't like me, and I don't like them. I'm afraid of them. And she said, come, I'll be with you. So I did. She said, go up and talk to these people. And it was a threesome, a dreaded threesome. So I sighed, and I stepped up and I said, hi, I am a scientist. I could have predicted the reaction. They just turned and went away and formed other three. But I could go back to say to Marion, you see, they don't like me. They think I'm weird. I'll never fit in here. She said, now, Marilyn, remember, I'm with you. Just go up and tell them how long you've been sober. Say your name and how long you've been sober. Okay. I walked up. I'm Marilyn, and I've been sober for 3 days. And they turned toward me, and they smiled, and I could say anything after that. And they just said, keep coming back, keep coming back. I heard it 1,000 times in that year. And I had begun to trust Marion. And I said, how is it, Marion, that you have answers for me when when I don't seem to... I mean, I think about myself 24 hours a day. And you probably only think about me maybe 9 or 10 hours a day. And she just laughed. She always laughed when I talked to her. And she said, oh, Marilyn, we're so much alike. That's how I know what's going to work for you. But it was a great kind of comfort, you know. And she even told me the answer to that thing that had baffled me all of my life. And that is, what do you say when somebody says, how are you? Laughed. And she said, oh, Marilyn, that's just a form of greeting. Now, remember, this is Alcoholics Anonymous, so nobody cares. And... she said, all you have to do is say, fine, how are you? Now try it. And I tried it, and we got around to the magic words, how are you? And I said, fine, how are you? And she started talking and talking. Right. We were in a conversation, and I looked at other people, and I saw that they think I'm a human being. They think I'm in a conversation with another person, and could hardly wait to get back to Marianne. And I told her about it, and she said, well, good, what did she say? And then Marianne gave me another wonderful term. She told me about self-obsession. And I began to understand why I had never been able to have a conversation with another human being. I had been thinking about myself all of my life. What do you think that I'm thinking? What do you think of me? What should I say next? I could monitor so well that I didn't even notice that you walked away. And Marian began to teach me to listen because she gave me quizzes. And I had to start tuning in. And early on in sobriety, the leader of the group, Clancy I, sort of singled me out for a little bit of advice. And it actually happened at a party for Carol's probably third birthday. And I didn't even think he knew my name, but he has kind of a stern way about him sometimes, and he just walked up and started out the conversation with, Marilyn, the trouble with you is, and you just don't expect a high compliment when somebody starts a conversation like that. And he told me something in his firm way, and it was that you're making your case out to be different. Why don't you just try to be like other alcoholics? Don't try to be cleverer than other people. Don't try to earn people's respect. Just try to do what everybody else is doing. And it just scared me. It scared me that he would talk to me like that. It was public humiliation, that thing that I hated. Ann Beverly was in the room, and she said, call me when you get home. We'll talk about it. I really wanted to go home and end it all. I thought, this is the most terrible thing. Here I am sober, I'm trying, and this person, this leader in the group, singles me out for humiliation. And true to my pattern, when he did that to me, I stopped talking to Clancy for 17 years. I showed him. Now, he didn't notice, but but it meant something to me. And but that was what I had done for so many years. If you say something stern to me, I just stand way back and try not to let it happen again. And yet Beverly was willing to talk to me that night for many hours into the wee hours of the morning. And I said, I want to kill myself. This is too horrible. I can never go back there again. And she just said, suicide's not an option for us. Drinking is surely not, but I don't think suicide. We talked about that and kind of concluded the evidence, but we concluded that we can commit suicide, but we're just going to be farther back. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. And okay, I'll hang in. And the next day she called. She said, you're still alive, Marilyn. Yep. So I'm glad because I want to kill myself today, and I need somebody to talk to. I said, it's not an option. Mm-mm. We did that for many, many days and years. We still do it. But God, with God's divine providence, has, or somehow, something has always seen fit that when she's up, I'm down, and vice versa. We've never been down at the same time. Otherwise, we would have formed a suicide pact, gone off the cliff like lemmings. And so it's worked. There's always friends that are up when I'm down.
And Marion gave me two things. She gave me entrance into the fellowship by just teaching me to get interested in other people and listening to them, sharing my own experience, strength, and hope. And in that conversation with Beverly about suicide, because I began to speak from the heart, I have gotten so desperate enough that I have let you know who I am. And that's the beginning of friendship. I missed it all of my life. I'd been off to the university, and I'd read books, but I didn't know how to have a conversation with another human being. I didn't know the first thing about normal living, and I was learning it in Alcoholics Anonymous. Marion was giving me another thing, and that was a program of my very own. She encouraged me to take the steps, and I said, but this God thing, I don't know what to make of that. I'm an atheist. And she said, just give lip service to it and write an inventory. Now, of course, I was glad to start in and write my inventory, because I got pen in hand and I wrote a soulless moral inventory of my mother-in-law. And Marion indulged me. She even listened to that whole thing and just smiled and suggested that I'll probably have to write some other inventories. But the thing that was so amazing was that she began to get me to see my part in this whole sordid relationship. And she began to open the door of willingness so that I could see that she actually came in and rescued our family and put amends to her. And I just thought, wait a minute, because that's going to give her so much power over me. If I apologize to her, she will really have control of me forever. She will have so much more power than she already has. And I was still afraid of her. But because I was desperate, because I had turned my will and my life over to Marion, I wrote the letter, and I said, I'm sorry for anything that I did that harmed you. Because, you see, I began to realize that that there were those moments. One time in particular, we were all in the living room, and my mother-in-law leaned toward me and said, Marilyn, what is wrong? We've always thought of you as such a nice girl. And I just felt that I thought, I am a scientist. How dare she talk to me like that? And I just leaned forward and I slitted my eyes and I said, well, I've always thought of you as a self-righteous bitch. I had to remember those moments, and I wrote the letter, and that was a real surrender. And lo and behold, she wrote back to me. She answered my letter, and she apologized for her part. I was just amazed. And she said that she had always just wanted to be accepted, just for whom she was, warts and all, she said. And I thought, my gosh, my mother-in-law is saying that. We began to speak the language of the heart. And we didn't become best friends because she lives 3,000 miles away. That helps. And and so we wrote letters, and but in these later years, she's got another in-law, a son-in-law, who's a bad alcoholic practicing his disease in full color. And I've been able to tell her about Al-Anon, and that's given her such comfort. And so we've almost come full circle with that. I talk proudly about being an alcoholic and the benefits, the great joy in my life that has accrued from that. And who would have thought, just starting with that amends letter, that it could have grown into that. And I wanted to go to work so badly. And I knew I could never work again after that, after those days in the lab and walking out like that. And Marion said, and other people, when it's time to go to work, there'll be a knock at the door. Right now, you've got to make amends to your family and get acquainted with your husband and your children. She suggested that I pray, because I just felt like I don't know my husband. There were a few attempts. An early outing, we went down to the beach, and the wide open spaces just about did me in. And I was sitting there on the sand, and it felt like sand flies and sticky and sun. And the kids were romping out. Life is so hard. Why even stay alive? A minute, he said, why not? Now, that's not sparkling dinner conversation, but it was a beginning. We were beginning to talk. But then I went overboard. I wanted to get to the bottom of this relationship. And Marion said, try to be a good AA, kind to him, and then try to be a good AA. But I wanted to have a heart-to-heart talk with him. And after 13 years of not talking, I just said, do you love me? And he looked at me and he said, I don't know what that means. And I was heartbroken. And I said, well, you're my husband. And I mean, it's a warm feeling inside. And he said, I don't know how to quantify that. And I said, well, I'm in this fellowship and they're going to ask me to go to any lengths. I guess I'm just asking you if you'll stand by me for that. And he said, I can't say that. And I was heartbroken and so alone and so frightened. And I said, that makes me sad. I feel so scared and so alone. And he just smiled and he said, I'm here today. And I called Marianne and I wanted to report this terrible conversation. My husband doesn't love me. He says horrible things to me. She said, well, what did he say? And I related the conversation and she said, Marilyn, he is such a spiritual being. He's here today. You're not there today. And then she let me begin to understand that there are no guarantees. We have a relationship with one another today. Let us fully enjoy this moment. That's what we have. And I was beginning to learn that. Bill already seemed to know that. And I was beginning to get acquainted with him like I talked to people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And slowly, ever so slowly, things were starting to happen. But I could still see him inside the house playing with the kids, and he seemed to be happy. And the kids were starting to smile, and he read stories to them. And again, there was that wall between me and my husband. I began to say a prayer to a God that I didn't even believe in. If you're there, please let me go in where it's warm, or at least walk away from the window. And nothing happened, and I still felt like I was outside in a snowbank looking in. But everybody said to me, just try to be a good AA. Just try to work a good program and work with others. And I was trying and feeling terrible. But around this time, I was starting to perk up a little bit. And I'll tell you, I was growing curious about this thing that people were calling God and higher power. I was coming to believe, because I had heard so many stories by this time, that even me, as arrogant and as unwilling to listen as I was beginning to hear something. I heard miracle after miracle. And I just looked around. I mean, look at the clientele. Look who we are. Look, I came in from the garage. And we come together and we heal one another. We raise one another from the dead. And I knew, given who we are, that just can't happen. And I was so curious. I was at that point. I had been taken to that point, now I realized, by participating in the program, by taking the steps. But one day I just said to outer space, if you're there, I'd like to get to know you. And if you're really there, I am willing to go on any path you pick for me. I have come to believe that it was the fellowship, the program acting in my life, that made me say the second part of that request, namely, I'll go on any path you take for me. What I really wanted was, if you're there, I want a mystical experience. Prove yourself. Give me a sign. And something in Alcoholics Anonymous had made me add that next thing, and I'll go on any path you pick for me. And much later, I realized that God will come in and meet me on God's terms. God will take me there. But I have to be willing to go on that path that God picks for me. When I said that, I knew that I had signed a mighty big contract, and it turned out to be. I felt like there was a lot of inner rearrangements, like God with a celestial jackhammer. And it was just the influence of the group conscience, the fellowship. And here I was in this big active Pacific group, Clancy yelling at me, friendships, gossip, threat, hurt feelings. These were the little cuts. This was the scalpel. And then there was always gauze, my friends with handkerchiefs to wipe the tears away. And that was God doing surgery in the group conscience, I do believe. That was the sixth and seventh step for me. And I was made into a being that could receive that radiance, that love that God is always emanating in the universe, from within and from without. And how it happened was, after I had taken the steps to the best of my ability, and I had gone through a couple of years of this kind of psychic surgery that the fellowship brings about, one day the veil parted, and it was that moment where I experienced that profound love from a higher power. And it impressed the hell out of me, because I had come from such a position of atheism, and I never really believed that anything was there, and it was revealed to me. And I went crashing back into AA meetings saying, let me tell you about this realization. I'd almost get started, and if I was talking to a newcomer, it was like the days of old where they would turn and form another threesome. She's weird. But if I was talking to an old-timer, they'd just smile and nod and say, yes, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, it was obvious to them. But it was a big deal for me, and it was a safety net. And I could then, kind of courage that I'd never had before. That was the security that I had always longed for and looked for me. And there it was. It's given me courage finally to come back when somebody lifts their voice. It's a funny thing. Clancy is my sponsor now. And every now and then he raises his voice. And without the safety net, without all of this conditioning in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd walk away. But I don't have to walk away anymore. Not bad to walk away, but it's so much better to hang in and drink of life fully. Because I miss out on so much when I walk away. There is always the prize if I hang in. And after the amazing spiritual awakening, the message was, go out and practice these principles in all your affairs, but stay tied to the fellowship. I had a lot of trouble letting go of the guilt I felt about the kids, and I had to make living amends to them until one day I could see that I just looked at them, and I could see that we're all children of God, perfect children, perfect parents, perfect God, perfect love. I may have thought that I damaged them, but that was then, and now is now, and I should not allow that guilt to diminish this day. Let's go out and play together. Now, I could never have come around to that intellectually. I had to be brought to that point of willingness to let go of the guilt by making living amends to my kids. And it took 5 or 6 years before that guilt was gone. I was getting acquainted with my husband, too. Alcoholics Anonymous has worked so subtly in my life that I never experienced it happening. When I know it's happened is when I am sharing with a newer person. I find myself listening, and a lot of times when I talk, women come up and they say, I feel terrible about my children. I drank while I was pregnant. I shook them when they were little. I feel so bad. And I begin talking to them, and I say, I used to feel that way. And let me tell you my story. And then I realize I'm using it that way. That's how I knew the guilt was gone, when I was using the past tense. And likewise, women say, I live in a home. I feel like there's a big wall between me and my husband. I try to talk about the relationship, but he says things that hurt my feelings. I just laugh and I say, God forbid, don't talk about the relationship. Get involved in Alcoholics Anonymous and ask God to let you go in where it's warm, or at least walk away from the window. And then I say, I felt that way when I was new. And then I realized that I was able to allow my husband to rip off his scientist suit. And I got to know him as Bill, fellow child of God. And we've been getting acquainted over the years, and we celebrated 35, many of them happy years together this past year. And that's a pretty amazing thing. And we've climbed mountains together and played with the kids together. I never thought that was possible. And when the time was right, the director of the old lab called and asked me to come back to work. Now, I was living in San Francisco, and I'd gone up there, and he called from Los Angeles. And when he asked that, I said, they said there'd be a knock at the door. And he said, well, the lab's here in Los Angeles, and you're up in San Francisco. It was hard to get your phone number, but... And we had planned to come back down. The timing was right, and there I was, working in that place. I thought that that would never be possible. But I have come to know that God meets me where I am. I sank pretty far into the depths of our disease, so God has had to do a little bit more work in my behalf. God has always done for me what I can't do for myself. God, I am sure, somehow, in a way that I will never understand, orchestrated Marion at my first meeting, orchestrated that against my better judgment and self-will, getting me into the Pacific Group, something that intense for an intense person like me. I see that God, in that situation, when I had no resume, surely, or a very bad resume, somehow brought his loving influence that I could go back and work in that same place where I did all the damage. Pretty amazing. I even saw my personnel file, and they didn't hold it against me. They just marked that I had left back in 66 or 67, and cause of leaving, they wrote, sickness. Yep, I got that one. And I've worked ever since. A danger, of course, has been my wanting to make work into God. I revert to that scientist mentality, making a job into God. Three letters, an O in the middle, so you can see it's easy to confuse. And it's been a great danger for me, but thank God I stay tied enough into the fellowship to get drawn back. And the longer I stay there, the less important that is. It's not important how I make my living. It's important that I go out and earn a living for God. Go out and serve in God's world. Turn my will and my life over to God each morning and just try to be of service. Try to be a good AA. As long as I do that, the funny thing is that I feel like finally I could open present number 27. It is the feeling that I open that and I got just what I always wanted. And you say, what is it? And I don't know, but I feel like I got it. But I was going after the Nobel Prize, but I got the Nobel Prize of sobriety along the way. And if I could put it into words, I suppose it would be that it's not about being rich or being poor or having a job or not having a job or being sick or being well or any of those things, having a car or a camera. But it's about having a sense of purpose, a language that you have given me that unites me to the human race. A loving relationship with you, with my family, with a loving God that I never expected to find. This abundant richness, all here, all for us. And I thank you for it.